Accession number 21095, reel 21.
GDR to mark the ceremonies. So I'm trying to.
This is Hella Peck, Reel 21.
I had gone to Berlin for the Gorbachev's visit, which was on again on the anniversary of the GDR, to mark the ceremonies, and there were always huge parades for these anniversaries, both during the daytime, the sort of military might of the GDR would be displayed, and then in the evening there was always a big torchlight parade, and as far as I could gather, normally these annual anniversary celebrations would be full of the most ponderous pronouncements about the achievements of the GDR and all the wonderful things which they'd done. I'd heard it all God knows how many times before, and so on. But anyway, the excitement this time was that Gorbachev would be there, and of course, you know, things were already beginning to happen in Eastern Europe, and it was 89, everybody knew there was something, that change was on the way, and everybody wanted to see what Gorbachev would do and say in the GDR, whether he would give his unstinted support, as the Soviet Union had always done, to the GDR, or whether this time there would be a difference. And during the day, and by that time, I had graduated, so to speak, to an improvement on the hotel where I used to stay, and I was staying at the Grand Hotel, which had recently been completed, and where a lot of the journalists were. It was just off Unter den Linden, and I remember during the day I went down and you know, watched some of the parades that were going on. It was all very stirring stuff, and then there were briefings by Gorbachev's spokesman, and there we saw what was in the offing, because there he reported to us that Gorbachev had delivered this warning to Honecker that those who wait too long or with their decisions, then sometimes, I can't remember the exact quote anymore, but the whole meaning of what Gorbachev had said was that if the GDR remained as rigid as it had been in its attitudes, the whole system, the Republic itself, the GDR, could collapse or would be undermined, because it was quite obvious by then that people were straining more and more to leave, and that the flow might become beyond anybody's ability to stem it, because people were getting out through some of the other East European countries and so on. And then in the evening there was this torchlight debate. And of course, we'd already written our stories saying that, you know, change was in the offing. Gorbachev had made these rather unambiguous remarks of warning to Honecker. And I saw the beginning of the torchlight debate, and it didn't seem to be quite like previous torchlight debates, because people were not cheering Honecker as much as they used to. They were applauding Gorbachev. But then I disappeared and went into the into the Distel Cabaret, and by the time I came out, the parade itself was over, and I went off to meet these people in an underground bar somewhere off the Alexanderplatz, and they told me about their lives and how difficult and how hard it had all been, and how they'd suffered and how they couldn't do this and couldn't do that, and how their education had been incomplete, and you know, all the kind of things one knew. But there was the sort of human interest story of really telling one as it was. And then I went back to the hotel, and I found the British ambassador sitting there, and so we, you know, analysed the situation some more, because by that time it was too late to write very much for the Guardian. That would have to be the next day's story. And, you know, we all agreed that we were witnessing the end of an era, but again, one still didn't quite know how far it would go, and the wall was still there, and it and hadn't really been seriously breached. And you know, after that, I went back to England, and then a few weeks later, when the wall was opened, I was actually in London, but I did spend that whole evening telephoning through to East Berlin, and in fact, again, managed to talk to the British ambassador and various other people, but of course it wasn't as good as having first-hand impressions. But then, basically, afterwards, we had correspondence all over the wall, everywhere, and that was. I still possess a piece of wall that was given to me afterwards, but. And there is also something, a very close friend of mine, a London art dealer, Wolfgang Fischer, went to Berlin the day after the wall was opened, together with a very well-known photographer who is of German origin, Fritz von Schulenberg, whose father was one of the part of the plot against Hitler. And Fritz took photographs of both sides of the wall in great detail, and that was turned into a book, which is an absolutely wonderful book with all the slogans that were written. And I've myself got an enlarged photograph which is framed, which has a sort of wonderful painting on it, which says, amongst other things, "Charlie, go home." So anyway, but that was. That was the end of the wall, but of course not the end of the GDR, because then we had the protracted 2+4 negotiations, which finally confirmed the international legitimacy of the reunification of Germany, and I covered all those in great detail, and. At the very beginning of those talks and the 2+4 negotiations had actually begun in Ottawa. I managed to do a very long interview with Edward Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, who had sort of got to know me through seeing me a lot already anyway. And I did a really big interview with him. And I was always very touched, because the next time I was at some meeting, I think it was again 2+4 negotiations, there was a press conference that he gave, and he immediately recognized me, and in some reply to a question said, "And you know, and I do want to thank Hella Pick or something for the no, sorry, that's not true." He wrote me a letter to say that he wanted to thank me for having written such a nice article about him, which actually was very unusual for anybody to do that. And it just confirmed to my mind that he actually was a very interesting man. And I'm sorry, I'm only bringing Shevardnadze into this now, because to my mind, I think this is one of the issues which still have to be clarified, how much he was responsible, the extent to which he, rather than Gorbachev, recognized that the communist bloc was at an end, that reunification of Germany had to happen, and once you had the reunification of Germany, you were on the verge of breakdown of the whole communist system. I believe that Shevardnadze understood that much sooner than Gorbachev. I think Gorbachev continued to cling to the idea that somehow, even if you can't save the empire, you can save communism. And I think that Shevardnadze recognized that you couldn't save either. And he was certainly instrumental in convincing Gorbachev that he had to sign the 2+4 agreement, even though there was a lot of internal opposition in the Supreme Soviet to that negotiation, because that sealed the end of empire. And I have a lot of respect for Shevardnadze, and in many ways I'm sorry that he then got into the morass of his own country, Georgia, and that he's obviously become a very different person down there. I've seen him once or twice at international conferences since then, but I mean, I've never seen him in situ in Georgia. But I did. I think I talked before about my little adventure in Georgia.
While you're still talking about Shevardnadze there, you were saying earlier about the gloomy Bermeco. This must have been an enormous change, wasn't it, to have someone like Shevardnadze?
Yes, Shevardnadze, yes. A lot of people like Shevardnadze. I think all the foreign ministers who dealt with Shevardnadze thought he was such a relief after Gromyko. And I remember the first time I met Shevardnadze actually was at a review conference of the Helsinki Declaration in Helsinki. It was in the middle of the summer, and I think the Finnish government had organized some big garden party for the whole conference. There were foreign ministers and heads of government and delegations and journalists and, a lot of people, and we were all milling around. And somebody took me to Shevardnadze, and I don't remember who anymore, said, here's Hella Pick of The Guardian, whatever one says on these occasions. And he looked at me and beamed at me, and he said, oh, I'm glad to meet you. My wife is a journalist, too. And it turned out that his wife was, in fact, sort of part-time journalist, and she was a very pleasant woman, and she was also then, we chatted for a bit. And that was the first time that I met him, and I liked him from the very beginning. He was at ease with himself, and he somehow wasn't as hidebound by the shibboleths of the communist paraphernalia. I think there was always he felt he was a freer man. Obviously, appearances can be very misleading, and he did certainly have a very nice smile, and he looked pleasant, and the contrast with Gromyko, who always looked dour and inward-looking, and there was no warmth to him at all. And then Shevardnadze is a typical Georgian, very warm, clearly sort of liked his glass of wine, and was gregarious, and to the extent that one could observe it, I think really did establish a good relationship with James Baker, who was then the foreign Secretary of State, the American Secretary of State, and with Jeffrey Howe, and later with Douglas Hurd. I think he was outgoing, and I think that helped a great deal. And I think he was very perceptive. I mean, possibly because he had more contact with the outside world than Gorbachev, but I think he saw that Glasnost and Perestroika had let a genie out of the bottle that you could never, ever put back in again. And I think he saw that much more clearly than Gorbachev did. But I leave that to historians to decide. But before I get too diverted by other things, I think perhaps I should go back again to the rest of Eastern Europe, because I did go fairly regularly to Bulgaria and to Romania, and to a lesser extent to Hungary, because in Hungary there was very little to report about Hungary. And again, as I said before, Czechoslovakia was a bit off the beaten track too for a long time. But Bulgaria was actually, and of course I did go to Yugoslavia in between a great deal. But Bulgaria was the first East European communist bloc country that I visited after I became East-West Affairs correspondent. And that was by quirk, because I had a friend who was in charge of something called UNIDO, the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Vienna. And he told me that he was organizing some kind of a conference under UN auspices in Bucharest. In Sofia, in the capital of Bulgaria. And if I wanted to come, he would sort of accredit me and I could come. So I said, yes, fine. And it was something to do with agriculture, and I remember I have some vivid picture. There was amongst the delegates, there were two women from Iran who came sort of in high heels and very elegant, and we had to go and visit a farm and sort of go through really muddy fields and look at cows and things, and there were these two elegant women in their high heels stalking around as well. I have a picture of that. I don't know quite what they were doing, but they were obviously discussing agriculture. But anyway, I had made a certain number of appointments. I'm sorry, I hope I haven't said any of this before. I'd made a certain number of appointments from London with various Bulgarian officials and to the extent that one could. And they'd allocated an interpreter to me for these meetings. And this was an extremely nice woman called Lily. I can't remember what her other name. Oh, I've now remembered the name of Gorbachev's spokesman, Gerasimov. Sorry, but anyway, Lily was my interpreter, and she was a very pleasant, youngish woman. And she, as we were waiting to see some official that I had an appointment with, she asked me if I'd been able to get appointments with all the people that I had asked to see. And I said, yes, the only person that I hadn't been able to fix was someone called Andrei Lukanov, who was the foreign trade minister, and where I knew the foreign office in London said to me, he's the one person that you really need to see, because he's very interesting and very outgoing, and he's worked at GATT in Geneva, so he's been out of Bulgaria quite a bit and so on. And Lily says to me, well, just a minute, and she makes a phone call in Bulgarian, which I can't understand, and she said, yes, okay, we've got an appointment this afternoon with him. And I said, how did you fix that up? And she says, well, he's my husband. And then she became, I mean, they both became real friends, because then the next day she invited me for tea or supper or something to their flat, which was, you know, unheard of. And when I told the British ambassador that I'd actually been to their flat, he said, but, you know, nobody ever gets invited. I mean, this is quite ridiculous. I mean, how come you get invited? But they did invite me, and they were extremely nice. They had both been educated in Moscow. They had met at Moscow University. They've been contemporaries of Gorbachev, I gathered. And but I mean, this was, I'd learned that much later, because I mean, in 75 nobody was talking about Gorbachev, as you can imagine. But this was still a period when, you know, everything was totally closed, and here were these two very nice people, you know, talking to me about, well, I don't know if they told me very much, but just the mere fact of being there and being made to feel at home in a communist leader's home was pretty amazing. And she told me then that her sister was married to a Bulgarian diplomat who was in London, and so, and anyway, we remained in touch, and then the next time I went to Bulgaria, obviously, you know, I let her know, because she worked for the official, again, for the foreign press organization in Bulgaria, and so she again met me and took me around, and we did things together, and she even took me to a little sort of dacha that they were building in the country. We drove out to that and came back again, and then she took me to see various wineries, and I was made to drink all sorts of horrid Bulgarian wine and things like that. And then just before I was leaving, she said she wanted to give me sort of various typewritten articles about Bulgaria, which, you know, might come in usefully, and also she had letters for her sister, and would I take them to post in London, so in other words it wouldn't go through the censorship. So I said sure. And she came out to the airport with me, and we said goodbye. And I had all those papers all in my hand luggage, and they looked at it, and they found those typewritten articles from Soviet press. And, you know, great furore, you know, I was taking out secret material, and there was nobody there who would speak English, and I kept on saying, this is Sophie Press, you know, but... And they held up the plane, and I really got terrified. But they somehow found Lily was still at the airport, and they found her, I think, or anyway, somehow contact was established, and she came back and sort of bailed me out. But and I managed to smuggle her letters out. But the adventures of coming. But somehow, because of that connection, I always enjoyed going to. There wasn't really. You couldn't find out much about Bulgaria, but it was an easygoing country, and I liked the Bulgarians. I thought they were very nice people. And then once I was there again with Geoffrey Howe, and there was an official lunch where I, for the first time, met Zhivkov, the president. And then I asked if I could do an interview with him, and then the Lukanovs did organize an interview with him for me, and I actually thought he was a very likable character. And I remember he always argued that the communist bloc was a bit like a medieval guild, and you either had to sort of fall into line, or you fell by the wayside. But that basically, they were a sort of mutual self-help society. And then Geoffrey Howe, he used the argument, because Geoffrey Howe said, you're being held down by the Soviet Union, and how terrible it was for you. Of course, one always has to remember that the Bulgarians really felt that they owed their independence, their pre-war independence to the Soviet Union, to Russia. And they always had, to the Soviet Union, they always had a special, they genuinely liked the Soviet Union, unlike the rest of the East European countries. The Bulgarians really had a lot of fellow feeling for the Soviet Union. But Zhivkov said, it's a bit like a colonial country in reverse. Whatever we manufacture here, we can dump on the Russians, because they're so much in need of every kind of consumer good. It doesn't really matter what the quality of it is, as long as we produce it, they'll take it. So, it happens to be quite useful to us. So, I mean, he recognized the limitations of Bulgarian industry too. He was a wily old character. Now he's sort of depicted as a sort of evil genius of Bulgaria. Again, I have to say, I really didn't quite see him in that light. But perhaps again, there's always the risk that if you have this any kind of personal contact with people, you perhaps see them as even more villainous than you thought before, or you think that they're slightly better than people depict them. And in his case, I found him rather disarming. I mean, something that I would never say about Mr. Honecker, for example. But I didn't get to interview Honecker, but I think even if I had done, I wouldn't have changed my mind about him. who can tell? But again, that brings me to Romania, because Ceausescu I did interview once, and that's quite a nice tale, actually. But, I must say, Ceausescu, the more I saw of him, the worse I thought he was. I never saw the slightest redeeming features in him, and I could never understand that so many Western leaders for so long went on investing politically in Romania, because they thought the very fact that he was prepared to oppose the Soviet Union on rather limited ground somehow turned him into a heroic figure who was and a rebel. He wasn't anything of the sort. He was one of the worst kind of dictators. And the fact that he did from time to time attack Soviet domination didn't turn him into a figure that for which one could have the slightest kind of admiration. I mean, one had to have nothing but contempt for him, in my view. And that was my view right from the very beginning when I started going to Romania. I always felt uncomfortable in Romania, perhaps even more uncomfortable than I did in the GDR. I think the Romanians, I hate to generalize about a people, but I think the Romanians really find it extremely hard to make the difference between myth and reality. And they painted the most extravagant picture of their success always to any visitor who came to Romania, when before their very eyes they could see that they were wrong. I remember once, for instance, they'd taken me to see some agricultural enterprise in outside Bucharest, and there they had me for lunch, and they laden the table with food, which they always did when they had Western guests. And then we were driving back along the main road to Bucharest, and suddenly we saw on the street there was a woman with a basket of cucumbers, and they stopped the car and bought a cucumber from her. And you know, my guide said, "Oh, my wife would be so pleased to have a cucumber." You know, for once they admitted they hadn't seen a cucumber in years, and there was a cucumber. But there was one occasion when I came to Romania with Lord Carrington when he was Foreign Secretary, and his visit involved going up country, and all the way, we were driving about 200 miles, and all the way up, they cleared the whole street, the whole road of traffic. There was no traffic, and every few hundred yards, you would see soldiers standing or police standing to attention to salute these speeding cars. And then we were there overnight, and then the British Embassy Jaguar broke down, and Peter Carrington had to travel back to Bucharest, all the sort of 4 hours driving with the Romanian foreign minister. And we were leaving to go back to London almost immediately afterwards. And I always remember when we got into the plane, Carrington, who never did mince his words, said, "I will never go through this kind of experience again, ever." And we then drank all the way back to London. And I don't know how any of us got out of the plane at the other end, but anyway, it was just the sheer relief of getting out of Romania. And then again, there was another occasion when I was in Bucharest when the Chinese Prime Minister paid the first ever visit to Romania, and they put on a sort of huge spectacle in the evening in some sports stadium, and the Western press, who had come for this happening, was also there. And after a while, we suddenly realized there's something very strange going on, because the people on the there was singing and dancing and going on, but somehow the singing didn't seem to be synchronized with what was actually going on the stage. And then we finally realized that we were listening to recordings of the sound, and that everybody was miming, and the only people who were genuinely singing were the gypsies, and who also had their turn. And when we asked officials about this, they said, "Well, we wanted to be quite sure that it all sounded right." I mean, it was just, again, another example of this inability to distinguish between fact and fiction. I mean, they wanted to, it was just amazing. But I think my worst experience with Romania, I think why I developed such an abiding hatred of Ceausescu, was he was invited on a state visit to Britain, because Britain had been trying for months and months to get him to sign a contract to buy British aircraft, and he was playing hard to get. And it turned out that the only way of getting him to sign this piece of paper was to have him on a state visit, and somehow the Queen was persuaded to go through with this. And she's known to have said afterwards, "Never again will I submit to this kind of indignity." They brought their own food tasters with them, and God knows what else. But anyway, before they came, the Romanians, I think, phoned every national newspaper to offer them an interview with the great leader. And I happened to be away somewhere in Eastern Europe, I think, when these phone calls came in. And our foreign editor, the Guardian's foreign editor, accepted on my behalf. And so I was landed with this assignation. And one of the things is the Romanians stipulated that, whatever interview the great leader gave would then be published in full in the British press. And I said straight away, you know, you're completely mad, to the Guardian. I mean, whatever happens, we'll have to cut this out, this interview. Anyway, so I flew off to Bucharest and arrived to be met by three members of the Central Committee of the Romanian Communist Party, who accompanied me to my hotel and who informed me that we would be negotiating the questions that I would be asking of the great leader.